It's been remarkably quiet here for the past week at Climate Conversations, but it's been equally quiet elsewhere. But more about that later. This is the latest episode of Climate Conversations, and I'm your host, Robert McLean. This podcast is assembled here in Shepparton, in northern Victoria, Australia, on the lands of the Yorta Yorta people. Yes, the stolen lands of the Yorta Yorta people. And I pay my respects to elders, past, present and emerging. And so what's been going on? Well, I've had a little sojourn in the hospital, both here in Shepparton and in Melbourne, at Western Health. And I've come out with a pacemaker. But that's the least of our troubles, for according to the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, West Australia has had its hottest summer ever, but climate change and heat-related health problems barely made the news. A caption for a picture associated with the story says, "Perth has always been hot, but climate change is making parts of the city unlivable in summer, for most of those vulnerable to heat, experts say." James Purtell wrote the story and he said, "In early February this year, when Perth's heat really got going, my partner was 28 weeks pregnant. On the day of the midwife appointment, we snuck to the car from one air-conditioned room where we both worked, huddled in the cool, windows up and AC on full. We drove to the hospital. The midwife told us the usual pregnancy things to keep the baby safe, but it felt odd to be learning about diet and sleeping positions while outside the city baked and trees died. We read scary stories showing the impact of extreme heat on pregnant women and unborn babies. We read that extreme heat kills more people in Australia than all the other natural disasters combined. This has been WA's hottest summer on record, and the hot weather isn't over yet." You'll find a link for that story in the show notes. Now we have 90 seconds from Yale Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. During the winter, Alexander Dupree loves to hop on a snowmobile to explore Canada's wilderness and to help others do the same.
It's really a way to get to places you could not otherwise. And we try to make it not only about the machine, but about the forest, about the nature, and about the beauty of the scenery we got around here.
Dupree works for NordXP, a company that leads snowmobile tours in the Charlevoix region near Quebec City and in areas farther north. He says when he got started in the industry 8 years ago, he could rely on good snow through the winter. But now, conditions are less predictable.
Sometimes it's because we had good snow, but it rained and it melted, or sometimes it's just no precipitation, snow or rain. Like this winter, we didn't have snow during Christmas, so we lost a lot of reservation and a big part of our season by the lack of snow.
And on frozen lakes and rivers, the ice conditions are getting less reliable. Dupree says to compensate for a less consistent snowmobiling season, the company is diversifying, adding summertime ATV and mountain bike tours. So as the climate warms, they'll have other ways to get people into the wilderness, even when it's not blanketed in snow. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
While in hospital last week, I contacted Violet Coco, and she agreed we could chat when I got home and feeling better. While I'm home, I'm feeling better, but sadly, Violet's not. Violet's had her jail term almost tripled. Here's the audio from a story in the Melbourne Age.
Message must be sent. Jail terms almost tripled for climate activists who shut down Westgate Bridge. Two climate activists who blocked peak hour traffic on the Westgate Bridge, causing a woman to give birth on the side of the road, have had their jail terms almost tripled on appeal. Deanna, Violet, Coco, 33, and Bradley Homewood, 51, faced the county court on Tuesday after launching appeals against the 21-day jail sentences they were given for their March crimes. The Office of Public Prosecutions also launched an appeal against the 21-day sentences, arguing they were inadequate. County Court Judge David Sexton said there was no doubt Coco and Homewood were passionate about climate change, but both had deliberately and flagrantly broken the law, putting lives at risk. This, he said, warranted 2 months in jail for each of them. While you may have been well-intentioned, the methodology you each employed to make your points caused a significant risk and disruption to the lives of others, Sexton said. Your sustained obstruction of emergency workers must be denounced, and a message must be sent to like-minded people not to engage in this type of illegality. The judge said both had significant criminal histories for similar offending across the country and were serving out court orders at the time of their latest arrests. The pair and another man, all members of environmental action group Extinction Rebellion, drove a truck onto the Westgate Bridge in peak hour traffic about 7:45 a.m. on March 5. They then climbed onto the parked vehicle, set off flares and unfurled protest banners. The court heard the incident blocked city-bound lanes for 2 hours, with a pregnant woman forced to give birth on the side of the road with the help of another motorist after becoming stuck in gridlock traffic on her way to hospital. In appealing the couple's sentence on Tuesday, Crown Prosecutor Jordan Johnston said that on the morning of the protest, 13,000 calls to police and 3 to paramedics had a delayed response due to traffic being blocked. These included calls to help with the imminent birth, and 2 calls to assist Victorians in mental distress at Broadmeadows and North Melbourne. In one of those cases, it took paramedics more than an hour to reach the patient. Johnston said the incident had cost the state more than $7,600, with 26 police attending the scene, plus a $300 towing fee for the truck. The protest, he said, caused upwards of 2 hour delays to inbound traffic and 30-minute delays on nearby roads. VicRoads data presented to court showed that during the same time the week prior, more than 14,000 cars passed over the Westgate Bridge in one morning. Taking to the stand to give her own sworn evidence, Coco said the science was clear that hell on earth awaited unless members of the community stood up to encourage change. She acknowledged the protest was disruptive but maintained it was proportionate to the environmental threat the world faced. "I refuse to give up, Your Honor," she said. Coco also spoke about learning there had been a roadside birth during her protest, saying it had hollowed out her heart with grief. "I drove that bridge so many times to consider the slower time for the speed of the cars to ensure the safety. We left 2 lanes open to allow the flow for some traffic," she said. "We considered there were hospitals on both sides of the bridge. This is a significant and catastrophic event that has occurred during our protest. For that I am deeply sorry. It's given me great pause and reflection and learning to change the way I protest." More than a dozen Extinction Rebellion supporters packed the county court on Tuesday. Security found extra chairs for some while others were forced to wait outside. Homewood, who remained in custody after his bid for appeal bail was refused, waved and blew kisses to his supporters as he was beamed into the room via video link from the Melbourne Assessment Prison. He also performed hand signals and beat his chest with his fists in response to Coco, his partner, flexing her muscles and blowing kisses to him via the live camera feed. Coco had been granted appeal bail last week but was taken back into custody following the judge's decision. Judge Sexton said it was clear both offenders had a history of disobeying the law, and he expressed doubts about whether they would stop offending in the future unless a significant penalty was imposed. He noted that they both were on court orders imposed in other states, with criminal records in places including South Australia, New South Wales and Victoria. He said Coco had 15 prior court attendances since June 2021. She is currently the subject of 2 New South Wales court orders. Homewood has 6 prior court appearances for similar offending since August 2021 and was serving a conditional suspended sentence and a conditional release order at the time of this offending from South Australia and New South Wales. Sexton set aside the 21-day jail sentence imposed in the magistrates' court and resentenced the pair, who had pleaded guilty to 2 counts of public nuisance and obstructing police and emergency service workers, to 2 months jail each.
The likes of Violet and her counterparts have my wholesale support. I really appreciate what they're doing, but I do understand why people get upset. I do understand why they don't like the disruption it causes to their lives. But the court system, like everything else, is about protecting the status quo, and the status quo has got us to where we are now, a climate system which is falling to bits quickly and threatening everything we hold dear. Let's do what we can to support Violet. Join me now as we listen to some audio from the Australian Broadcasting Corporation's Breakfast Program.
Last year was hot. It was the 8th hottest year on record for Australia. High temperatures in the atmosphere and oceans, along with a roller coaster of climate events, made 2023 a wild year for our environment. More animals and plants were added to the list of threatened species, and those already on the list declined at a faster rate. That's some of the findings of Australia's annual environment report produced by the ANU. Professor Albert van Dyk is the lead author and joins me now. Professor van Dyk, welcome to Breakfast.
Thank you.
2023 was the hottest year on record globally, but not for Australia. What happened?
I suppose the weather happened. it was a very hot year globally, but Australia escaped, I suppose, the worst of that, mainly because it rained quite a lot during the early and the later part of the year. That probably contributed to slightly lower temperatures. But as you said, it was still the eighth hottest year on record, with all those 8 years happening in the last 10 years.
You've described it as a wild year for Australia. How do you summarise the state of the environment in Australia after a hot 2023?
Generally speaking, the environment's currently not in too bad a state. It was a wild year. It started very wet, coming out of a series of La Niña years. Then it got very dry from May onwards. And by August, the fire season had already started in some states, and it was looking pretty dire with an El Niño developing. But then in November, the rains came back, and it, I guess, prevented a very dry fire summer. So yeah, it was a bit of a roller coaster ride, as you say.
And there was, thinking back, there was a bit of an expectation of, and we've had fires in some areas, but of it being the big bushfire season, and that didn't eventuate in some parts of the country.
That's right, and that's mainly because of those rains returning in November. Otherwise, it probably could have worked out a lot different. The fire season, as I said, already started in August in Queensland and New South Wales, and there were several fires. But then I guess the vegetation got doused a bit, and worse was averted.
And looking at biodiversity, what's happening to the number of species that are under threat in Australia at the moment?
Yeah, well, I guess that's just climbing year on year. This last year, we had 130 new species added to the list, making it over 2,000 species on the threatened species list now. That was a very high number. Typically, there's only about 30 or 29 species added every year on average. That was mainly consequence of a deeper dive into what happened to the species after the Black Summer fires, and obviously that wasn't good news for quite a few of them.
There are now around 27 million people living in Australia. As the number of people grows, what sort of impact are we having on the environment directly?
Yeah, a whole raft, I suppose. But what comes to mind immediately is that our emissions of greenhouse gases per person are not really going down very fast at all, and certainly not able to offset the increase in the population. So actually last year our emissions went up again as a country rather than going down, which is where they should be heading. So that's the contribution to global warming. But of course, all those people that keep adding to our population also need houses, need land, and that is water as well. That's also, of course, added pressure on our environment.
What surprised you most from the data for this report?
I guess what's for me as a bit of a geek, I suppose, but what's most interesting is that when you look at the average numbers, it seemed a reasonably average year, but it was hiding some real extreme kind of events. So the winter was the warmest and the driest on record in many parts of Australia. And a lot of your listeners probably would have noticed that it stopped raining for quite a few months, and then fortunately in many places it started again. So it was very warm also the winter, which is the warmest winter on record, as I said. But you don't really see that in the averages. So I guess for me that was a bit of a surprise, if you like.
You have said, though, that amongst the worrying statistics, there is hope. What is happening that gives you some hope, Professor van Dyk?
Well, you have to have hope, don't you?
You do.
I guess there is hope. For instance, I guess the worst problem we as humanity are currently grappling with in an environmental sense anyway is global warming. And I guess there's hope there in the sense that we see the electrification of society happened quite fast in many other countries, not in Australia, unfortunately. But we can look at many developed countries in Europe and also the US to a certain degree, and we can see what we have to do to catch up, basically, with those countries and be responsible global citizens. And if we all do that, then I think worse can be averted in terms of global warming. It's not looking good at the moment, not good at all, but we can turn this around, and so you know, we have to try.
Professor, thank you.
You're welcome.
That's Professor Albert van Dijk, the lead author of the 2023 Australia's Environment Report, which is produced by the Terrestrial Ecosystem Research Network and the Australian National University. You're listening to Breakfast.
Join me now as we listen to a story from the Melbourne Age about the problems faced by renters.
Summer temperatures can range from uncomfortable to nearly unlivable inside Australian rental properties, which renters say affects their health and ability to use their home. Tenants sweltered through a hot summer, with a rental crisis and the cost of living that left some unable to afford to run air conditioning, or worried about asking their landlord for improvements for fear of eviction, research from advocacy group Better Renting has found. Health professionals and community groups have spoken out in support of strengthening minimum standards for rentals to include insulation and cooling, to alleviate heat-related illnesses. In Sydney, Marrickville renter Andrea Leong was among 123 tenants who tracked temperatures and humidity in her home with a smart thermohygrometer from early December to late February as part of Better Renting's report Cruel Summers, Renters' Diverse Experiences of Summer 23-24. Her home peaked at 31 degrees and 75% relative humidity. The heat affects her sleep and flares up her dihidrotic eczema, which blisters her hands and feet. The heat also makes it uncomfortable to have guests over. The minimum across the whole period was 24.5 degrees, and the humidity usually sits around 60%, the microbiologist said. Even though we knew it was hot, it was shocking to confirm that it doesn't really get much below 25 degrees, even at night. That's despite keeping heavy curtains drawn on hot days, having double glazed windows in the bedroom and a split system air conditioner in the living room, which she considers herself lucky to have, along with a landlord who does repairs when needed and takes their responsibilities seriously. Leon had previously stood for election with the Science Party and the Fusion Party but is no longer active in those parties. In Melbourne, Brunswick West renter Madeline Cooper said the city's most recent heatwave in the second week of March made her bedroom unusable for 3 days. The hottest it got in my bedroom was 31.9 degrees. The maximum humidity in this room has been up to 93%, and the humidity is sitting at 63% right now. So it also gets damp, she said. Cooper's landlord recently installed an efficient air conditioner in her living room, but the home's poor insulation meant its effect was muted. Cooper, whose long COVID symptoms were exacerbated by extreme temperatures, said she felt the rental crisis made finding a new, better home prohibitively difficult. I can't really afford this place, and I can't afford to move. And finding a cooler, better insulated rental in this market is basically impossible, she said. Renters have to put up with what we have. Better Renting director Joel Dignam said indoor temperatures higher than 25 degrees were cause for concern, because of the effect it had on sleep and other health conditions. The renter researchers found this summer that their homes were above 25 degrees for 52% of the time in New South Wales, 20% of the time in Victoria, 87% of the time in Queensland and 67% of the time in WA. The overall picture across Australia is that it's been pretty grim, and this was a hotter summer than the last two summers, which is reflected in the data, he said. Overnight, you're well past the healthy threshold for sleep at that point. Ideally, you'd have a home sitting around 21 degrees. But at 25 degrees, you're out of that comfort zone. We find renters are spending a lot of time out of that comfort zone. Renters often said their home felt hotter inside than outside. So the study compared how often the outside temperature was greater than 21 degrees and the indoor temperature was even higher. Of the period when it was more than 21 degrees outside, it was hotter inside than out for 13.5% of that time in Victoria, 42.5% in New South Wales, 37.4% in WA and 63.6% in Queensland. Some participants in the study also said they were struggling with the cost of living, which affected their willingness to run an air conditioner. They worried about making trouble with their property manager, struggled to sleep, or wanted to move but found the alternatives were too expensive. One with heat-related health issues was forced to call an ambulance when their symptoms escalated. Another, in the past, had to sleep in a tent in the yard as a better alternative to their hot home. The report recommends minimum energy performance standards for rental homes and improving the power of renters to exercise their rights. Sweltering Cities Executive Director Emma Bacon recently spearheaded an open letter addressed to the Victorian government, which was signed by more than 50 doctors, housing and health organisations, and called for the adoption of insulation and cooling minimum rental standards. What we are doing with doctors, health experts and housing advocates around the state is making it clear to the government that there are health impacts to not considering cooling in the minimum standards. Doctors are hearing from patients that they're getting sick because of the homes they're living in. The Victorian government could reduce the health burden on the community by making this simple update, she said. If Victoria is the first state to put cooling in the minimum standards, we would hope the rest would follow. Leong would like to see minimum energy performance standards introduced for rental properties and better design outcomes for new buildings. Having a healthy home shouldn't be a matter of striking it lucky. Everyone should have a safe home, she said. Real Estate Institute of Australia President Leanne Pilkington said housing standards would improve as states and territories updated minimum standards. She encouraged landlords to speak to their property managers to understand their obligations and how to best improve the energy efficiency of their investment properties. It's more of a focus now than ever before. The summers are getting warmer and I just opened my electricity bill and it's $400 more than the last, she said. Everything is getting more expensive, including electricity. It's much more top of mind than it was 12 months ago. Key points. Rentals regularly spend hours above 25 degrees during summer. Indoor temperatures higher than 25 degrees are associated with poor health outcomes. Tenants are pushing for stronger minimum standards for rentals across the country.
Troubles arising from ever-increasing heat are manifesting themselves everywhere. And just recently, a 23-year-old man died at a music festival. Let's listen now to the audio from a story in the Melbourne Age by Lachlan Abbott and Rachel Eddy. It has the headline, How Many Lives Do You Put at Risk? Anger After Man Dies at Music Festival During Heatwave.
The family friend of a Melbourne man who died after becoming unresponsive at a music festival is dismayed the weekend event went ahead despite soaring temperatures and extreme fire risk warnings. Anthony Mowgarry, a 23-year-old from Nidri, became unresponsive just after 1 a.m. on Sunday at the Pitch Music Arts Festival in Mafeking, near the Grampians in Victoria's West. Victoria Police said he was airlifted to hospital but later died at the Alfred. Ambulance Victoria said five festival-goers, including Mowgarry, were taken to hospital because of suspected substance use at the festival near Ararat, where temperatures reached 37 degrees on Saturday and a total fire ban had been issued. A family spokesman, Simon Ead, questioned why the music festival proceeded, with about 18,000 expected attendees, despite the Country Fire Authority telling people to stay away and other events, like the Moomba Parade, being cancelled due to the heat. How many lives do you put at risk? Ead wrote in a text message. He added that Mowgarry's cause of death was yet to be confirmed. Mowgarry's immediate family were too distressed to comment on Monday, Ead told The Age via the phone of the aspiring DJ's father. Pitch was ultimately called off on Sunday, with thousands scrambling to leave the bushland site amid another total fire ban in the southwest on Monday. On Sunday night, festival organizers posted on social media they were deeply saddened to learn this evening that one of our people of Pitch has passed away. Our thoughts are with their family, friends and anyone in our wider community affected by this. A friend of Mowgarry posted a tribute on social media, calling him their best friend. My life will never be the same. I will think about you every hour of my days. I will never let go of you, the friend said on Instagram. Rest easy, sweet boy. On Saturday, ticket holders and concerned family of attendees slammed the Pitch Festival for mixed messaging and pressing ahead as the mercury neared 40 degrees and extreme fire danger ratings were issued. Organisers initially cautioned attendees to follow CFA advice and stay away, but didn't cancel the event near Moyston that began on Friday. In an update on Monday evening, organisers said the final attendees who stayed overnight were now leaving after authorities directed the festival to call off the event on Sunday afternoon. We have consistently followed the guidance of relevant authorities throughout the entire process, a spokesperson for the festival said on Sunday. Ambulance Victoria said two other festival goers were flown to Geelong Hospital in a critical condition after incidents involving suspected substance use. Two others were taken to Ballarat and Ararat hospitals in a stable condition, the paramedic service said. All of them were men aged in their 20s and 30s. Pitch Festival organisers were contacted for further comment. The tragedy sparked a renewed political debate about introducing pill testing at festivals on Monday, despite the exact cause of Mowgli's death not yet being determined. The Greens issued a statement claiming the Pitch Festival death could have been prevented if Victoria had pill testing. It is devastating to hear about a young life being lost over the weekend while the new premier sits idle, said AIV Puglialai, the party's drug harm reduction spokesperson. Opposition leader John Pesutto said the government needed to create better alert systems for dangerous drugs and impose stricter obligations on festival hosts. The coalition does not support pill testing. We need to do better at education, the Liberal leader said. This is a tragedy. A Victorian government spokesperson said there were no plans to trial drug checking. We send our deepest sympathies to the young man's family and friends during this difficult time, they said. Separately, the spokesperson said festival organisers were required to have an emergency management plan for extreme weather. Pitch's plan was activated when an extreme fire danger rating was declared on Friday. The plan's design meant the festival needed to be cancelled or suspended when another extreme rating was declared for Monday. Before the weekend, authorities were more concerned about the health and safety risk of partygoers during a heatwave than they were about the risk of bushfire. The Department of Health in January released a drug alert that warned about the risk of taking stimulants such as MDMA in hot weather after overheating was linked to a mass overdose at the Hard Mission Electronic Music Festival. Two other drug alerts issued since then have warned about a pink and white capsule sold as 3CP that contains a potent opioid and an off-white powder sold as 2CB that contains two synthetic drugs with a high risk of toxic effects. The Pitch Music Festival fire safety plan, which did not cause concern for authorities, was to shelter in place rather than evacuate, a source with knowledge of the plan said. Police will prepare a report for the coroner about Mowgli's death.
The complications and challenges arising from our ever-increasing heat are many, and one is told in a story from the Melbourne Age about the family of an athlete who died from heatstroke, who is now suing organisers for millions. The headline suggests such lawsuits are almost certain. Let's have a listen to the audio now.
The family of an athlete who died from heatstroke sued organisers for millions. Lawsuits in Australia are almost inevitable. Lawsuits against sports that don't protect their players from extreme heat are almost inevitable in Australia, as the effects of climate change continue to rise. A new report by athlete climate advocacy group Frontrunners and lawyers at the Environmental Defenders Office details how climate change is already affecting sports and putting athletes in harm's way. Frontrunners was co-founded by climate campaigner Emma Pocock. Environmental Defenders Office Chief Executive David Morris said sports administrators from grassroots to the professional level needed to consider these risks, not just because there's a moral imperative, but because they pose a key business risk. He said a claim in Australia was almost inevitable. The risk of being liable for an impact to someone in terms of personal injury or in terms of economic loss, it's almost certain, Morris said. There is precedent of this overseas. Last year, a family in the United States reached a US$14.1 million, $21.3 million, settlement with Kentucky University after their son, 20-year-old Grant Bruce, died of heatstroke after a training day with the wrestling team. In the lawsuit, the family claimed the wrestling coaches ignored Grant's dehydration in what they described as punishment practice. The previous year, the family of London endurance cyclist Barry Covington, 36, reached a six-figure settlement with the insurers of the UCI Gran Fondo Amateur World Championships after Covington died of heatstroke while competing in the 93-mile event in the south of France in 2017. The lawsuit claimed the sport's governing body, l'Union Cycliste Internationale, which organized the race, didn't do enough to safeguard competitors from the risks of heatstroke. In Australia, major tournaments have been affected by heat, including the Australian Open. Play was suspended at last year's tournament when the temperature rose above 35 degrees and there were concerns for the safety of ball kids. At last year's US Open, Russian star Daniil Medvedev said during a match played in 37-degree heat with high humidity, One player is gonna die. Soccer's A-leagues and cricket's Big Bash leagues have also suspended matches because of heat. Sven Burcharts, a sports lawyer and partner at Kalu's Kenny Intellex, said he absolutely expects sports organisations to be on the receiving end of lawsuits as extreme weather worsens in Australia. And if you're a director, particularly again under an occupational health and safety regime, you can be held personally liable in certain circumstances, Burcharts said. Burcharts added each code, sport or event would have different things to consider, and the responsibility would depend on the context. You have to understand the context, the level of professionalism, the level of athleticism, the fitness, what the normal parameters of a particular athlete's activity are, and what's acceptable, so there's sort of no one-size-fits-all approach as to what's a reasonable precaution to take, Burchard said. And then there's the competing issues of, you may be part of a competition that mandates that you have to field the team. Dimi Ioannou, principal lawyer at Maurice Blackburn, added, guidelines differ from state to state, but generally, before an event gets the go-ahead, organisers must have carried out a comprehensive risk assessment, hired enough appropriately trained staff and produced a detailed emergency management plan. The report found that while some sports bodies had thorough policies on how to approach extreme heat, including detailed wet globe temperature index figures, which factor in temperature, humidity, wind speed, sun angle, cloud cover and solar radiation, others were rudimental or, in some instances, non-existent. Morris said those without a plan risked getting caught out. In those circumstances, it won't be good enough to say, well, we had this inadequate policy. You will need to be able to show that your thinking on this was sophisticated and that it came up to level that was required of you to discharge your duty of care to those people. Evidence-based policies don't just minimize the risk of a lawsuit, they also provide players with an added layer of safety when facing weather-related health risks. Nicola Barr, who plays Australian rules football for GWS, said it was important evidence-based policies were enforced, as it wasn't presently clear whose responsibility it was to protect people from extreme heat in sporting contexts. Just like any other workplace, if you're an employee of an organisation, you want your employer to have your best interests at heart, and I think unfortunately, athletes over the last few years have been experiencing more and more extreme weather events that are impacting them firsthand, Barr said. Barr, who is also a frontrunner's decarbonising sport representative, said she hoped the health risks of climate change would be considered at a board level, so that athletes didn't suffer from heat exhaustion before anyone was sued. Prominent sports lawyer Ben Elay, KC, said the reasons individuals could be held liable were based on well-established legal principles. Sporting organizations and infrastructure operators who fail to acknowledge and address those legal risks are leaving themselves open to suits brought by athletes, spectators, and even commercial partners, he said.
I'm a bit behind with this story because it's from March 8, but I think it's worth reporting. It's by Mike Foley from the Melbourne Age, and the headline for the story is, Like Chasing Tasmanian Tigers, What's Behind the Coalition's Nuclear Push? It seems rather silly to me that any thinking, reasonable person could possibly imagine nuclear power to be the answer. Evidence from all around the world illustrates that renewable energy, for which Australia is really well placed, is vastly cheaper. And so, I think Peter Dutton and the LNP is, to put it colloquially, barking up the wrong tree. Let's listen now to that story from the Melbourne Age.
Australia's climate wars are cranking back up to full power, as opposition leader Peter Dutton mounts a challenge to Labor's ambitious renewable energy agenda by declaring a coalition government would replace coal-fired power stations with nuclear plants. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese said following his 2022 election win that his government would massively boost renewable energy and end the climate wars that have gripped politics since former coalition leader Tony Abbott helped bring down the Gillard government with a scare campaign over a carbon tax. But Dutton has reignited the fight, offering voters a stark alternative to the government's plan, which has wind and solar at the heart of a rapid transition to clean energy. The opposition's proposal would slow down the renewables rollout, creating time to replace aging coal plants with nuclear technology. But many questions remain. Which communities would host a nuclear plant? How much would they cost? Where will the high-grade nuclear waste generated by the power plants be stored? And crucially, do Australians support an end to the Howard government's 1999 ban on nuclear power? Election risks. Climate policy was a hurdle for the coalition at the 2022 election, where voters backed the Albanese government's more ambitious policies over the Morrison government's pledge to cut emissions by 26% on 2005 levels by 2030 and reach net zero in 2050. Dutton must now convince voters that nuclear plants can be built cheaply, safely and in time for Australia's legislated climate target of cutting emissions by 43% by the end of the decade. That appears almost impossible. Australia's former chief scientist, Alan Finkel, said in August it was highly unlikely that Australia could open a nuclear power plant before the early 2040s, pointing out the autocratic United Arab Emirates took more than 15 years to complete its first nuclear plant using established technology. There are a lot of very attractive things about nuclear energy for our clean energy transition. The problem is timing and cost, Finkel said at the time. If we did large-scale nuclear power, I would imagine something approaching 20 years in Australia. With little prospect of nuclear power in the short term, Dutton must make the argument that Australia should halt its commitment to the Paris Agreement, miss its 2030 goal and keep coal plants running until nuclear plants are built in time to replace them. Lobby group Solutions for Climate Australia said the coalition's nuclear plans were a dangerous distraction that cannot reduce climate pollution this decade. They have declared they plan to keep burning coal and gas until an unknown time in the future when nuclear reactors may come online. But international examples show huge delays and cost blowouts on large reactors, Solutions for Climate Director Barry Trail said. To give just one example, the latest British large-scale nuclear reactor is £17 billion, $33 billion, over budget and now 6 years beyond its planned finish date. If it's ever completed, it will be the most expensive power station in the world. Grattan Institute Climate and Energy Director Tony Wood said it was extremely unlikely that Australia would find political support to overturn its nuclear ban and source enough investment to build power plants. It's like saying we're going to build an enclosure at the Taronga Park Zoo for Tasmanian tigers. But there's no such thing as a Tasmanian tiger anymore. The idea of doing that in Australia just seems too incredible, and until they turn it into a real policy, you can't have much of a conversation about it. Clean energy debate. To date, the coalition's nuclear push has been hypothetical and limited to the emerging technology of small modular reactors that experts say may be decades away from deployment. But the coalition declared this week that traditional, large-scale plants are also firmly in the mix. It slams what it has dubbed the government's reckless race to renewables, claiming regional communities will disproportionately bear the brunt of new wind and solar farms needed to decarbonize the grid, as well as the extensive network of transmission lines to hook the clean energy into the city. Dutton stresses that he wants nuclear power to bolster electricity supply to the grid and support renewables when the wind isn't blowing and the sun isn't shining. He warns the government risks blackouts by forcing too much renewable energy into the grid without enough continuous baseload supply from either coal or nuclear plants to back them up, that taxpayers will be on the hook for a massive bill for expanding the network, and that pristine farmland and natural habitat will be damaged by the infrastructure. Dutton has promised to release detailed nuclear plans before the May budget, which is when the coalition will face the same questions it has been asking the government about renewables. Experts warn Australia's nuclear regulation, currently equipped only to oversee radioisotopes used in medicine, would need to be dramatically beefed up, sites selected for construction of a reactor and for waste disposal, and a fund set up for decommissioning. A typical large nuclear reactor produces 25 to 30 tons of spent fuel a year, and the high level of radioactive waste contained in it can remain toxic to humans for tens of thousands of years. It's like saying we're going to build an enclosure at the Taronga Park Zoo for Tasmanian tigers. Grattan Institute Climate and Energy Director Tony Wood. Defence Minister Richard Marles has said the nuclear waste from nuclear-powered submarines that Australia will acquire under the AUKUS pact will be housed on defence land. This could potentially also store high-level nuclear waste from power plants. But the controversy surrounding the selection of the first site to permanently house Australia's low-level radioactive waste shows the political risks involved. The Albanese government last year abandoned plans for a facility to take medical waste at Kimba, in rural South Australia, due to community opposition. What's powering nuclear policy? The coalition's caution over nuclear power when it was in government has waned since the 2022 election, not just because the alternative to renewables provides an opportunity to attack the government, but because it is also the most likely way for Dutton to hold his party room together. Former Federal Energy Minister Angus Taylor said in 2019 that the Morrison government had no plans to lift the moratorium and any changes to the moratorium would need bipartisan support and broad community acceptance. But Dutton is alive to the risks for a coalition leader promoting renewables. The Turnbull government's National Energy Guarantee, which ultimately failed after opposition from the coalition backbench due to its promotion of renewable energy, was a major factor in the downfall of the then Prime Minister. For now, the coalition is united behind the nuclear push. Senior moderate Simon Birmingham, the leader of the opposition in the Senate, is backing nuclear as a clean energy option to drive down emissions. This is a matter of some political courage by Peter Dutton and our team to look at something that historically has been put off the table in Australia, Birmingham said earlier this week. The Nationals, and the right wing of the Liberals, also back nuclear as a way to slow down the energy transition until retiring coal plants can be replaced with another form of baseload power. I'm proud to say I made it clear to Peter Dutton that when I became Nationals leader, we were going to run with this. But he's had the courage to come with us, David Littleproud said on Wednesday. The Paris Agreement requires members to cut emissions in line with international efforts to keep global warming under 2 degrees, a goal the Albanese government has not yet met, and to increase the ambition of emissions reduction goals every 5 years. However, Littleproud called for a moratorium on the renewables rollout last month and argued that Australia should prioritise reaching net zero emissions over short-term targets. We don't need to do all this by 2030. We've got to 2050, so why wouldn't we pause and get this right, he said. Voter shifts. Nevertheless, Dutton has selected energy as a major policy battle for the election. The federal government in 2022 set a legally binding climate target to reduce emissions by 43% by the end of this decade, in large part by slashing reliance on fossil fuels and doubling the share of clean energy in the electricity grid to 82% by 2030. Albanese has rejected the coalition's nuclear policy escalation as implausible. Many Labour MPs are opposed to nuclear power, and Climate Change and Energy Minister Chris Bowen has derided the coalition's policy as an unaffordable, ideological tactic to delay renewables. However, the coalition is banking on growing support for nuclear power, particularly among younger voters who don't remember meltdowns at Three Mile Island in the United States in 1979, Chernobyl in the former USSR in 1986 and Fukushima, Japan in 2011. Dutton said this week that concerns relating to older reactors did not apply to modern nuclear technology, and Australia should follow the lead of the 19 other countries in the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development that used nuclear power. It's like comparing a motor vehicle you're driving off the showroom floor today in 2024 to something in 1954, he said. Why younger people are embracing nuclear technology is because they're well-read, they're passionate about reducing emissions, and they understand what's happening in Europe, what's happening in North America, what's happening in Asia. The Resolve Political Monitor, conducted for this masthead by research company Resolve Strategic, surveyed 1603 Australians in February and found 36% supported the use of nuclear power, 23% opposed it and 27% were open to the government investigating its use, with 15% undecided. Support for nuclear power has ticked up since October last year, when 33% supported it and 24% opposed it. Resolve Director Jim Reid said voters were increasingly open to the potential of nuclear power now the coalition was advocating for existing technology in large-scale plants, but support for the policy would not be truly tested until Australia's ban was lifted and a construction site selected. We've got a new generation of younger people, and they actually are quite positive towards nuclear power, Reid said. It swung towards at least openness to nuclear power, but it's weak support at the moment simply because people aren't being asked to approve an actual site. Power policy costs. A CSIRO report found in December that by 2030, a grid with 90% wind and solar power would generate electricity at $70 to $100 a megawatt hour. This figure includes more than $30 billion of new transmission lines and battery and pumped hydro projects to provide backup power. Coal generation is more expensive at $85 to $135 a megawatt hour in 2030. CSIRO found that if small modular reactors were available today, based on the current projections, they would generate electricity at a cost of $210 to $350 a megawatt hour in 2030. The report did not calculate a cost for large-scale nuclear, but addressed the argument that Australia should follow the lead of countries that use it, such as France, the United Kingdom, United States, Canada, Spain and South Korea. CSIRO said claims of cheap nuclear power in these countries were ignoring the fact that their plants were either funded by taxpayers as opposed to private investors or had been in operation for a considerable time, over which the capital costs had already been recovered. Such prices will not be available to countries that do not have existing nuclear generation, such as Australia, the report said. Wind and solar cripple coal. Cheaper renewables are displacing coal power in the grid quicker than expected. The Australian energy market operator in December forecast the country's last coal plant would shut in 2038, 5 years earlier than it predicted just 2 years ago, with cheaper renewables undercutting fossil fuel profitability. Dutton says the government is forcing too much renewable energy into the grid without sufficient backup power. They're trying to turn the old system off before the new system is ready, and if you do that, not only will you have that disruption to supply, you'll have an increase in prices, he said on Wednesday. The market operator does not agree with Dutton. Its latest projections show wind and solar will boom, with the most likely outcome that the electricity grid will continue to meet its reliability targets and operate without blackouts, as it is powered by 95% renewables backed with 5% gas power.
Yes, we've reached the end of this episode of Climate Conversations. Thanks so much for your company. It's been great to have you along. Now, I'd love you to share this podcast with your friends. Put it on your networks. Let people know what's happening with the climate crisis. We need everybody on board. For as it was once said, to change everything, we need everyone. Also, I'd love to hear from you as to what you think about this podcast. So you can contact me at r.mclean7@icloud.com. Don't hold back, good or bad, please let me know. Also, I'd love to have your voice on this podcast, so contact me through that previous email address and let me know. We can have a chat and you can give me your views on the climate crisis. And we'll organise some way to contact you and record our conversation. It'll be great. So until we talk again, please take care, stay safe and please be kind. For everyone you meet is fighting a great battle. Now take care and stay safe. I should mention, of course, before I go, that I still have a screen full of stories, so I'll put as many links as I can in the show notes. So go there, check them out, make some decisions about how you will respond to the climate crisis. Now take care.